Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Center of Everywhere podcast by the Center for Rural Policy and Development. I'm Marnie Werner. I'm the Vice President, and I'm here today with Julie Tesh, our CEO.
Hello.
What do you want to say to the folks out there?
Well, I'm glad that, you know, this is our fourth episode, and I'm glad that people have been listening in. This has been a really crazy time with the pandemic, and I think that we've been able to have some really relevant conversations here on the podcast. So I'm really excited for this one on rural healthcare.
Yeah, and it's really been interesting seeing how technology is our friend. You know, we say the center is located in Mankato, Minnesota, but the three of us live in three widely spread out different places. And so we've been able to use our video conferencing to record these podcasts and get them out there. And so that's been a nice little technological experiment.
It has been. You know, when technology works, it is wonderful, as we all know, and I chuckle about my internet connection. But, you know, today we're all good, and hopefully there's no glitches or no delay in lag time. But, yeah, it really is crazy that we can connect from all over and that we can have Zoom meetings with anyone across the country or the world if we have to. So it's pretty cool.
Absolutely. So today, our guest is going to be our third staff member, Research Associate Kelly Ash. We have a new report on the state of rural healthcare, basically, coming out. And we're going to be talking to Kelly about why this report and why now. This report came about because we do an annual survey that we call our Thought Leader Survey. We use a survey to pick our projects for our research agenda every year. We come up with various questions that we think would create important research for rural Minnesota. And then we survey about 1,500 to 2,000 people to ask them how they would rank these projects. And this particular project on healthcare access in rural Minnesota came out, I think, at the top. And so this has been a big project. It's been an important project. And we're really happy to be getting this out here now in a couple weeks. And we're going to be previewing it. Kelly's going to give us a preview of the report. So, hi, Kelly.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Glad to be on.
Good. And yeah, this was a really big report. This is a big deal in rural areas. So why this report and why now?
Well, coming out of our thought leader survey, there was a lot of conversations, I think, happening around southern Minnesota and Albert Lea and Austin and the Mayo Clinic system and kind of what was going on there and some of the consolidation of services there. And then talking to other folks across the state, I consistently heard from constituents that, yeah, our system just got bought up by a larger system and they kind of started taking away some of our services, consolidation. And you're just kind of hearing a lot of this murmuring across all of rural Minnesota. And so that kind of inspired us to look a little bit deeper and kind of try and see what does this mean for access and what's kind of causing this, these mergers and acquisitions.
And this has been going on for a while, right? And not just like in southern or southeast Minnesota. This has been going on all over the state.
Yeah, it's gone out. Yeah, all over the state, you're seeing hospitals merge and be acquired with larger hospitals. And it's not just hospitals, too. It's important to understand that this is all clinics. This is physician groups. Now we're seeing it in pharmacies. And they call it vertical and horizontal mergers and acquisitions across the entire healthcare industry. And so yeah, it's a very interesting time. And as far as like how long this has been occurring, you know, we've talked a lot about, I would say, during the 90s and the early 2000s, you heard a lot about hospital closures. I would say mergers and acquisitions have been occurring at that point as well, but I think it's really picked up speed throughout the 2000s and going into the 2010s now.
And how do the mergers, what does that mean for access? What exactly is the problem in rural areas? What problem does it create?
Well, I think to fully understand, you know, how we, you know, why that's happening. We kind of have to understand how we got here. And I would say a bulk of my research over the past 6 months has been trying to understand the context as to, you know, the economic field and the policy field in which this is occurring and kind of driving this trend. So really, you need to look at the entire industry dating back to the 50s and 60s when we started developing Medicare and Medicaid. And even before that, you know, healthcare was largely paid for as a fee-for-service style model. So you would go to the doctor and you pay for the visit, you pay for the nursing, you paid for the x-ray, you paid for the blood work. You know, every little thing and procedure that was done at that time, that's what you paid for. Now, what this led to, particularly during the 70s, as a huge boom in the cost of healthcare. And, you know, research was done in the 80s and 90s, all this research coming out showing that we were paying the highest rates for healthcare with some of the lowest outcomes, you know, in the industrialized world. And so this really started to get policymakers and legislators kind of on edge to kind of figure out, okay, what are we going to do about this? And even in the 80s, they started talking about, okay, how do we start controlling costs in the healthcare market, and particularly around healthcare services? And through the 90s, through the 2000s, and now just with the ACA just being passed, a lot of the regulations have been trying to drive healthcare towards a new model that's values-based care is kind of, there's a couple different terms. I typically in the report use values-based care, and that's a shift away from the fee for service. So values-based care really is driving our healthcare services to think more, I would say, holistically. It's driving not just a doctor to work with one patient, but a doctor to work with a team of physicians and specialists to treat a patient. That's kind of the big change, is looking more towards outcomes. So if a doctor is setting up their services and their treatment for a patient that is entirely based on outcomes and the research based on outcomes, this also opens up the ability for insurance companies and government and other payers of healthcare services to start paying for outcomes rather than services being served. And that's a humongous shift in the entire market. And that's kind of been occurring, like I said, kind of started in the 80s, and it's really been picking up speed throughout the 2000s. And that is what is driving a lot of the mergers and acquisitions in the healthcare market amongst all the healthcare services. And the key to this is understanding that the healthcare providers kind of have to meet certain demands with this new payment system, this new values-based payment system. And what it means is that hospitals can no longer, since they're not being paid for, let's say, one patient that is getting this particular service, but they're getting groups, or they're getting paid for a group of patients. They're getting a lump sum, let's say, to say, hey, you know, you're going to treat these types of 400 of these types of patients. This is the amount of money you're going to get. Figure that out. That's a big change. And so what this means is hospitals need to take up a couple different strategies. So, and I shouldn't say hospitals, this is also healthcare providers, so physician groups and everybody. So one is taking on risk sharing. So since hospitals or healthcare providers are no longer reimbursed for what it costs to treat each individual patient, they have to figure out what it costs to treat a whole group of patients. And you're gonna have a bunch of those patients come at a pretty reasonable cost or expense to treat, but then you're gonna have some patients that are gonna be huge outliers. They're gonna be very expensive to treat because of whatever, but they're no longer getting paid for those outliers. They're getting paid for that group, or that's kind of the drive in the market right now to look at that. And so that means healthcare providers really need to figure out risk sharing. They need to have a large enough patient pool, kind of like car insurance or any type of insurance. You need to have a large enough pool to spread that risk out so you don't have these huge ups and downs within your patient pool. Well, when we started interviewing some of the experts to kind of talk about what is a, you know, what would a patient pool look like that would kind of normalize these risks and standardize it across the pool. You were, you know, healthcare providers, they were saying we're looking at 100,000 patients. Well, there's not 100,000 patients in a lot of our smaller rural healthcare provider systems. So that kind of leaves them at a loss as far as trying to share this risk across patient. You also have advanced statistics and analysis that needs to be done. Sometimes a lot of our smaller rural healthcare providers don't have that expertise in their employment. There needs to be technology investments, particularly with the ACA that came out. There was a pretty big mandate that made smaller rural healthcare providers take on electronic health records. That was EHCs, they always call them, or EHRs, electronic health records. And that actually is a very expensive thing to implement, particularly if you don't have that many patients. You know, they don't really scale to a lower scale. It's kind of these IT companies that develop software and put the infrastructure in. They kind of just give you like, here's the software. It's going to cost you a lot no matter how many patients you have. So the technology investments that need to be made are pretty significant, and a lot of our rural smaller healthcare providers aren't able to do that. The two other pieces that I think are important to know is I was talking about how healthcare providers need to figure out a way to treat patients as a team. So you kind of have, you might have your physician, but then you have all these specialists, right? We're a very specialized healthcare industry now. And these new policies and payment ideas that are being implemented are really incentivizing this kind of team approach. So if a patient comes in and they have some sort of ailment, they may talk to the doctor, there might be a physical therapist, there might be a nutritionist, there might be all these other kind of specialists that need to work with this patient, and they all need to coordinate. And they call it enhanced coordinated care. Well, for some of our smaller rural hospitals, one of the biggest issues they have is actually hiring specialty physicians, specialty care doctors and things like that to take on this type of team approach. So it can be more challenging for our smaller rural healthcare providers to offer that sort of care. Thus, then they sometimes lose out on some of either the grants or incentives that are attached to that team approach for care. And then the last thing I'll say is just, you know, how it works is economies of scale. Finding efficiencies. If you have a lot, if you're serving a lot of patients, you are able to buy supplies at a larger scale, and you get them at a per unit price that's lower than if you have, if you're buying less bulk. And that's just kind of efficiencies across the board and across hospitals and healthcare providers. So that's kind of like this big drive that you're seeing, and kind of why this drive in the new payment scheme is kind of putting our smaller rural hospitals that have low patient pools or smaller patient pools kind of at a disadvantage right now.
So what does this change mean specifically for rural towns? What does it look like to the person on the ground when they hear that their clinic is going to merge into another system? And why would a clinic, you know, we always think of hostile takeovers, but these aren't hostile takeovers. The hospitals and clinics often want to do this, right?
So why is that? It was kind of one of the surprising things going into this research. I too kind of had this maybe a little bit of a narrative of like, yeah, they're just kind of coming in and taking over. But from what I heard over and over again, even from the smaller rural hospitals that might be independent right now, is that they want to be acquired. They want to be a part of a larger system because, as I explained, through this new payment system, it allows them the ability to meet some of these demands and strategies that have to be implemented to meet this new payment scheme and to take advantage of some of the more revenue enhancements that are available. Without them, you know, they're kind of left on their own, just sitting there losing money. So I'd say that's a big thing. And, you know, when we looked at the financial records for all the small hospitals across the state, there was definitely, you know, the smaller and the more rural the hospital, the lower its profit margin was, if any margin at all. In fact, a majority of our small rural hospitals are losing money. They're not making any sort of profit at all. And so that's concerning. So these hospitals are trying to find ways to merge and be acquired so they can kind of spread their risk, have the ability or access to specialty doctors and technology and the people that can do the analytics and the larger systems. You know, it makes a lot of sense. For the larger systems, they may look at a smaller rural hospital and they'll just say, hey, we can increase our patient volume even more. We can have more leverage. And so this adds a couple of things. One, larger patient pool kind of helps in this new system. So they get to add that patient pool into their system. But also what you find in a lot of our rural areas is that gives them more leverage with insurance companies. And so there's only one or two insurance companies many times fighting for patients in our, fighting for our population in our rural areas. If anybody is listening, you know what I'm talking about. When you look at our insurance market, you go online, it's like, oh, there's two insurance companies that I have a choice. They look great. But what it means for a hospital system that goes and buys the acquires or merges with this smaller hospital is that they have significant leverage now with that insurance company to come in and say, hey, yeah, we know you insure all these people, but you also insure all of our folks in these larger hospitals too. So how about we negotiate a higher price for some of these services that we provide? And that makes sense. They're just going by the market. No ill intent. The hospitals are not trying to, make anybody mad. They're not trying to make money. They're trying to meet the demands of this new system and the cost efficiencies while also trying to play the market a little bit to help themselves out. So that makes a lot of sense. So that's kind of why you might see that happen. For folks on the ground, it's a mixed bag for our communities and citizens across the board. So, if you talk to people in, let's say, Albert Lea, this is where you heard a lot of this conversation happening with the Mayo. And the Mayo came in, I forget, maybe it was in the 90s or I can't quite remember when they bought the Albert Lea Hospital. But they came in and bought it, and it was community or county owned at the time. And the county said, fine, you can have it. With the idea that, they would continue to do the services and then they have access to Mayo specialty care. That's great. It was a win-win for everybody. Well, the Mayo is facing the same kind of payment changes and the changes in the healthcare market as every other hospital. And they recognize that in Albert Lea, they were losing money. You tend to lose money, particularly obstetrics. Hospitals across the state will say obstetrics is one of the highest cost, lowest profit, if any profit at all, services they can provide. So obstetrics and other kind of inpatient services, they decided to take those from Albert Lea and just merge them into Austin. For folks in Albert Lea, and I think it's important to know that we're not just talking about folks in Albert Lea, that there's a whole group of people surrounding the area surrounding Albert Lea that use that hospital, right? So everybody's always like, well, it's only 15, 20 minutes from Austin. What's the big deal? Well, if you were 15 or 20 minutes away from Albert Lea, now you're 30 to 45 minutes away from Austin. And so that's kind of, I think, where sometimes the rural thing gets lost, is that we're not talking about a single community. It's many times that these hospitals serve a pretty large range or a pretty large area of people. And that area can be 15 to 30 to 60 miles, depending on the specialty care that somebody needs, obstetrics being one of them. Talk to somebody up in Cook County about obstetrics and you'll get a whole string of curse words and, can't believe we can't give birth up here at all. It's like, yeah, it's crazy. So that's the thing that gets lost, I think, when you just look at, oh, what's wrong with Albert Lea? Well, we're not just talking about Albert Lea, right? We're talking about the whole region. But then there are other, you'll hear other stories, I think, where there may be a merger and acquisition of a smaller hospital in a rural area, and they may be quite pleased. It might be community or county owned. They kind of started to lack the specialty to run a small hospital or clinic. And they're like, yeah, take this over and it might start running better. They might start making profit. You may see a few services be consolidated, but some people would argue that even though you lost that specialty care, the quality has increased for the ones that you do have access to now, even though you have to drive farther, right? That's kind of the counter to that argument that you'll hear sometimes. So I would say for folks on the ground, when it comes to access, in rural areas, we've always had to drive farther. I think in our report, let me pull it up here, we gave actually a few numbers of what it looked like for access for certain kinds of care. So here we go. So average miles traveled for, we did three different inpatient services just to kind of give an example. So cardiology, for metropolitan based patients, they traveled on average 21 miles to get to have their cardiology service. For our most rural population in the state, they had to travel 77 miles. 21 versus 77. That's a pretty significant gap. And that's cardiology. It's not like it's something like crazy, like, yeah, you only need that, maybe never. I mean, cardiology is a big deal. It seems like we're all have bad hearts or need it checked up once in a while. And so that's pretty significant. One of our worry then going forward is, will this access continue to grow as mergers and acquisitions occur? Because these larger hospital systems are going to look at the consolidation of services as a strategy to cut costs, particularly now with COVID-19 and the lack of revenue coming into our smaller rural hospitals. They're going to be losing a ton of money. And so, you know, one is they're going to do it, or two, it kind of gives them the best optics to do it, because they're like, look, we don't have any money left. We're completely broke. We're taking that service away. We're consolidating here where we can provide it for way less money. But then folks will probably have to drive farther. Unfortunately, we don't have a real good idea of what kind of impact that might have on access. So,
right. So the implications from the pandemic could just aggravate the situation.
I predict that it's 90% certain you're going to see an increase in consolidation of healthcare services across the state. I've even heard some hospital administrators say we might even be talking about closures.
Right, because
wow.
Yeah, I don't know how much people are hearing that all the elective things that had to be stopped for the last month and a half or 2 months, those are the revenue sources for healthcare.
That's right.
And so they've basically been cut off from their revenue sources for the last 2 months.
Yeah, yeah. So Minnesota just opened up so they can do elective services again here in Minnesota, but that was cut off for a solid month. And that is their revenue, the main revenue stream for a lot of healthcare services. But you also have this fear in the public of even showing up at a hospital right now. And so that's going to hit revenue for we don't know how long, right? So that's kind of the uncertainty moving forward too, is like, it's not just we stopped elective surgeries. We've also have a public perception kind of psychology aspect moving forward here of when are people actually going to feel safe, like they can show up for their appointments again. Another example I'll give is that, so my wife, actually, this is more personal, but she tried to schedule her annual appointment for this June, and the hospital told her they're not taking those appointments for another 4 to 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
So
well, I was
kind of
surprised too, because they're just totally prepared for the COVID-19 and the break, the outbreak, that they're just not taking anything else on. So even though they're allowed to, hospitals are making a conscious choice that they just feel like they can't right now.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. Where does telehealth come into all of this? I mean, you know, it's something we've been talking about for a few years of, oh, telehealth this, telehealth that, but this has really brought the situation forward. Did you find anything about that?
So since COVID-19 is relatively recent, I didn't get anything that was like super, what are people doing right now? Not data-wise, I should say. Anecdotally, I'm hearing a ton of it. It's kind of like the final push over that cliff. Like you said, we've been talking about it for years, implementing it. People are like, yeah, we should do that. We should do that. And now we have to do it. And so hospitals are implementing it as best they can. From what I've heard, you know, so it spreads across all services. Where I've mostly heard it, actually, interestingly, is mental health. So counselors, psychiatrists, and things like, and psychologists have been using this pretty extensively. I don't know to how successful it's been, but they've used it and they've had to use it. And I have talked to people that at least appreciate some sort of connection and haven't totally been cut off. So maybe not as good as in person, but at least it's something. But I also have heard anecdotally that, you know, some of our smaller rural hospitals, this goes back to that technology investment piece again. It's like, yeah, we really want to do telehealth. We just can't afford it, or we don't have the technology set up, or we don't even have the broadband for it. Not only in the hospital side, but our patient side too. Julie, I don't know how many times we've had team meetings for our listeners. Julie lives on a farm out in outside of Wadena, and
Waseca.
Of Waseca. And
Waseca. So, other part
how many
of the
times
state,
have
yeah.
we had to stop our team meetings because your internet sucks?
Oh my gosh, yeah, it's awful. It's awful, and that's just here. I mean, if you have, yeah, I mean, there's so many areas across Minnesota that don't have that basic access, and if you want to talk to a doctor, you're kind of out of luck.
Yeah. But I will say that this is at least a really good shove to get people starting to do it and think about it. Yeah. The other thing I've been hearing a lot about is because everybody's having to meet on Zoom. So even my mother, you know, I've been meeting her on Zoom and she's had to figure it out. And so now we're making people that really need healthcare, so some of our older populations, force them to take that jump and say, all right, this is how an online meeting goes. So they're starting to get that experience. They're getting kind of an initiation in it through their family. So that's a good thing that they're not, you know, the doctor isn't the first time they're using some sort of video conference or something like that. So there's some good things coming out of this that are preparing people for the future, which is good. But
good point.
So where do we go from here? It sounds like as healthcare continues to adopt this value-based and outcomes-based payment philosophy, your report was concluding basically that the mergers and acquisitions are going to continue. So are we just stuck in this pattern then?
Yeah, I think... you know, there's some folks that say, hey, how do we stop the mergers and acquisitions? Just from the research that, you know, we've kind of done, I don't see that happening. I don't know how it can. If you want to be more cost effective, if we want to reduce the cost of healthcare, this is probably going to have to be, going to be one of the ways it happens is the mergers and acquisitions across our healthcare system. I mean, why wouldn't it? We've seen it throughout our entire economic system. Why wouldn't it happen in healthcare, one of the number one profit generating industries in the country? So yeah, it's going to happen, particularly on a state level, because so much of it is controlled at the federal level. At the state level, then what does that mean? Well, that means accepting this trend, accepting like, yep, mergers and acquisitions are going to happen. And accepting that large healthcare systems are going to look at the consolidation of services away from smaller, not as profitable hospitals as a strategy to be cost effective. It's one of their main strategies. Why wouldn't it be? It makes sense. As this occurs, I think the state needs to implement, or we kind of suggested some things I think that the state should look at. The first big one was actually looking at what used to be called the Certificate of Need policy program. We don't have that in Minnesota. We kind of have remnants of it. So it's actually backwards from where we're at today. So back in the 80s and 90s, we wanted to stop the big hospital boom. Essentially, we were putting hospitals and healthcare clinics all over the state. And this was happening across the country. And it was raising costs because people were building facilities that needed to be paid for. So we started implementing policies that if a hospital or healthcare system or whatever wanted to open up a hospital or a clinic with beds in it, they would have to go through a process with the Minnesota Department of Health to kind of analyze, are you needed? And we still have that on the books today. So if a hospital system moves into Minnesota, they actually have to go through a process with, I think it's the Department of Health Economics Program, and then they'll assess like, okay, are you needed? Are the number of beds you're planning, is that amount needed? Because we don't want you to build more than what's needed because then it'll cost more. Well, that really isn't where we're at. I would say kind of industry market standpoint, we're on the opposite side. We don't have enough competition in rural areas and we have hospitals leaving, not coming. And so one of the proposals we kind of put forward, I shouldn't say proposal, but suggestion was for state policymakers to kind of look at what if we implemented a policy on the front end. So instead of trying to have people go through a process wanting to come into some way, come into a small rural community, what if they went through a process where a system said, no, we're pulling out. We're going to take these services away from a rural area. And it doesn't mean that they can't, but at least there's a system set up or policy or process that says, okay, you're going to do this. That means you have to, let's say, hold some community meetings. You have to get input from local leaders. Maybe the health economics program comes in and does an assessment on what does this mean for access. So if you're going to take obstetrics away, who was being served by this service and where will they go now if they can't go there? What does access look like? After that is done. That's the thing that's not being done right now. And it also gives the community a little bit of time to, one, maybe negotiate with the healthcare system to try and find a way to keep it, be able to open up talks, or two, at least for the community to have a conversation about, well, if they won't fill it, maybe somebody else could provide these services, or maybe somebody's willing to come in, right? It just kind of like stops and gives everybody a breath that this is happening because it's a big deal. It's not like Sears pulling out of a out of the mall, you know, in Wilmer or something like that. This is a hospital. This is a healthcare service. This is something significant for a community. And so that was kind of one of the big things we suggest is that, you know, there's a process put in place where there's a community conversation and some feedback and some input about this happening. Another couple of ideas too is every hospital system or healthcare system is a little bit different. They're, you know, when they come in and merge or acquire a different provider in a different area, they may have somebody from the local region be on their board. So there is a local decision-making process for services and things that are done, but not all healthcare systems do that. It might be important that we recommend that the state mandate that that has to be part of the process is if you're going to merge or acquire somebody that's in a different county, that somebody from that county needs to be a part of your board of directors. You know, as legislators continue to look at ways to, I would say, minimize the growth in costs on the hospital side, that they make sure they do an assessment on what that means for smaller rural healthcare providers. Because if we're going to cap costs, that isn't equal across the board. It's always going to cost a little bit more money to deliver services out in rural areas for everything. We've seen it from social services to law enforcement, and you see it in healthcare. There's just no doubt about it. And if you're going to cap costs, well, some of those costs make a bigger difference in a rural small hospital than they may in a metropolitan-based one, which has higher patient pools. So things like that were some of our bigger suggestions to policymakers is as they move forward, just recognize that there's a humongous difference in metro and rural areas and how they function in healthcare.
And even within a healthcare system, you have those smaller rural hospitals and then the bigger hospitals in the population centers, and those rural hospitals could be operating at a loss while the larger hospitals are operating at a profit. So you see that difference even within, I mean, that's what this is all about, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we provided actually the Mayo Health Clinic, their entire systems, not the Rochester one, all their other hospitals. And we actually looked at their financial performance, and they're scattered across the board. Some were making profit. I shouldn't say profit, but making a margin, like a positive margin, and some were negative in the same system, right? Actually, Albert Lea and Austin, that was one of the reasons Mayo decided to consolidate, is because they were losing quite a bit of money in Albert Lea. And so they had to do something. Even within their own system. So, yeah.
Okay. So, what else? Julie, you have any questions?
Yeah, you know, I wonder about competition, you know, because there is a lack of competition out there. There's just, how do we get competition in the medical area? I know you talked to someone from Iowa. You know, how is there an opportunity now when things are merging? Is there opportunity for competition coming in?
Well, that was what was really interesting, talking to the Albert Lea folks. So they have a group down there called Save Our Healthcare. And they got put together right when Mayo announced that they were pulling out obstetrics and some of their inpatient services away from Albert Lea towards Austin. And, you know, one of the reasons they formed that group was to try and negotiate with Mayo. And, you know, they weren't able to negotiate. So what Save Our Healthcare and Albert Lea did was put out they hired two contractors to come in and do a financial feasibility study on whether Albert Lea could support a level 2 trauma hospital system in the community. And the experts came back, they did this analysis and says, yeah, with the right patient pool, yeah, it could work. But it's got to be the right system. You know, one of the things about Mayo is that they're very, very expensive. They're probably one of the most expensive hospital systems in the entire country, if not world. And with Mayo pulling out, so then the Save Our Healthcare said, well, hey, how about we just check in with a couple of hospital systems, see if they're interested in coming in? And the largest hospital system in Iowa, Mercy One, decided, yeah, we'll come in. Let's figure this out. And so they got Mercy One. And what was interesting is the community group there bought the Herberger's building in the mall or something like that. And they're leasing that to Mercy One to come in and start this hospital. They got kind of like a 5 or 10 year plan to kind of build it up to a level 2 trauma center. So that's really putting some competition with the Mayo there, because the Mayo is continuing to offer, you know, outpatient services and some of their current services there yet. So it'll be interesting to see as this moves forward what that competition will look like. And again, going back to the policy perspective, if we can get you know, something in the state level to say, hey, you know, if you're going to pull out services, that's fine, but we're going to organize some community conversations and have some research done to see what that looks like. Access, it kind of elevates the conversation and maybe garner interest from other healthcare providers or some interesting companies that might want to compete with whoever was there to offer those services again. At least it kind of elevates that conversation. That would be fantastic to see in our rural areas, because there really isn't competition at all right now. It's pretty much gone.
Yeah.
And it does feel like the system we have with our current healthcare is cemented in place and we don't have any options, but that whole situation with Mercy One shows that there could be options. There, you know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing.
Yeah, they are a really interesting case study on what to do and how to make that happen. I was talking to one of the organizers of the Save Our Healthcare, and he said he's received quite a few phone calls from other communities asking how he did that, how they were able to get somebody to come in and compete. So there's interest in rural areas to have this conversation and to figure it out. I think for a long time, rural leaders looked at this situation and said, well, what are we going to do about it? They're pulling out services. Obviously, we can't be involved. Maybe that can stop and maybe they can be involved.
So it's not a foregone conclusion.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So do you have any more questions, Julie, or should we do the little
wrap-up? No, I don't. I'm really excited for people to read through this report and digest it some more and really think about their rural areas. So I'm just glad that we could have this more in-depth conversation ahead of time.
Great. So when is the report coming out?
Fingers crossed, the report is going to be coming out Wednesday, May 27th, or at least right around there. So right after Labor Day or Memorial Day. Boy, I'm already throwing the summer away.
Do that.
After Memorial Day, the week after Memorial Day is when we're looking at that.
And we're going to be hosting a webinar on this report for interested people, right?
Correct. And we don't have an exact date on that yet, but we had a very successful convening, I guess, a few weeks ago with some commissioners from the Department of Ag and DEED and Department of Health. And we're going to do kind of a similar model at the beginning of June, hopefully, talking about rural health care, our findings in the report, but then talking to different experts around the state on rural health care and what they're seeing. So we'll be asking for questions to ask our panelists and whatnot. So people should be looking out for that on social media coming up here, hopefully beginning of June.
Great. So our guest today was Kelly Ash, our research associate at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And so I'm Marnie Werner, and along with Julie Tesh, hosting the show today, this has been episode 4 of The Center of Everywhere, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.